UMD's second annual Creativity Conference was organized around the ideas of creativity across disciplines and cultures this year. But as our free-ranging conversation with the two conference guests unspooled, it became apparent that creativity is not only useful in a wide variety of contexts, it lurks in some unlikely places. Culture, creativity, language, and how a better understanding of all three might be the key to unlocking some global conflicts, coming up on this half hour of Community Conversations. Let's meet our guests.
My name is Nora Naranjo-Morse. I come from New Mexico, and I am from a small village called Santa Clara Pueblo. And because dirt is such a huge resource in New Mexico, our houses are made of dirt, our vessels are made of dirt. So my mother was a potter. Her mother was a potter, and so I followed that tradition for most of my life, although I've gone into other mediums where I work. Right now I'm working with a lot of the tribes. I just came from Washington. There were 10 different indigenous artists from the Northwest Coast, and we created an installation for the college longhouse, and it was called Swimming Together. Everyone made a fish. And we're going to be installing it sometime next year.
Hi, I'm Dennis Cheek. I'm the executive director of the National Creativity Network, which was established in the state of Oklahoma and works across North America, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. It's a fairly new nonprofit organization, and we're trying to really advance creativity, imagination, and innovation in communities across North America, and linking up also with partners elsewhere in the world. And I'm also the co-founder of another organization called Global Creativity United, which is a loose alliance of 9 organizations currently that span the entire globe and over 170 countries. And we're trying to advance the same sorts of conversations really at a global level through various activities. So I'm highly interdisciplinary myself by background. I have backgrounds in biology, history, education, and theology. I've taught at 17 colleges and universities on 3 continents, and I've traveled all over the world and worked in many, many different places and continue to do so. And I'm absolutely delighted to be here in Duluth.
Dennis, I've got to ask you, when you go to a cocktail party and people ask what you do, you're the what of the who? An executive director of something with the word creativity in the title?
Well, we think about it as imagination, creativity, and innovation, and this is really part of a continuum. So the fact that it exists, I think, is a testament to the fact that across all different areas of human endeavor and across economies around the world and societies around the world, there is a growing awareness at the policy level and also at the practitioner and organizational levels that somehow we need more of this, and we need better manifestations of these things in our world, in our societies, in our organizations, and that we'll be better for it, our organizations will be better for it, and the world, hopefully, will be better for it. Having said that, we also, of course, have to acknowledge that there are bad forms of the expression of imagination, creativity, and innovation as well in the world. And so you want to be a positive force for good in the wider world as well. And so it's important. There is sort of this juxtaposition of, can you organize these things? And I think we think of it from the standpoint that we're about helping to create supportive environments where imagination can be more regularly unleashed, where creativity can be tapped with greater frequency and with greater effect, and where innovation can really take those creative ideas and then make them work in the real world. Because it's a long way from an idea in your head to an idea that actually works in the real world in some tangible, visible, impactful sort of manner. And to me, that's the business of innovation. And if you add one more word to this, that would be entrepreneurship. That really is about thinking about scale. How do you get to some kind of a scale in the impact that you're making that moves beyond and ripples beyond just a single point, but much like a ripple in a pond really does, in fact, move outwards, progressively expanding as it goes.
How have we managed to accomplish this shift, especially when there are universities that are, as UMD is doing, going through budget cutting issues and having to take a really hard look at the bottom line, and yet something as soft, for lack of a better word, as creativity is being taken very seriously. How did that come about?
It's actually quite complex, as many things are. And even when I think about creativity, I think about creativity with a small c and creativity perhaps with a big C and maybe even a super big kind of creativity that gets manifested now and again on a much rarer basis. So if you think about the creativity with a small c, from the time you're little, throughout your entire lifetime, every day in your life, you engage in creativity with a small c. Because that's about problem solving as an active participant in the world in which you find yourself, which is in and of itself complex, constantly changing, and every day you're presented with challenges in your personal life, from the very mundane and simple to things that, you know, move up the scale of complexity, and you have to navigate your way successfully through the world you inhabit. Well, every day in order to do that successfully, you are in fact engaging in creative problem solving, where you're coming into a situation, you're analyzing the need, you're trying to apply various kinds of tools and techniques that you have in your head or you have in your physical body, even in some cases, in order to successfully find your way through that situation in a way that you feel pleased about, hopefully, by the end of the day. We all have days where maybe it's not quite so straightforward and you didn't succeed at the level you would like to have. But that's always, of course, a growth opportunity for you as well when you experience some failure along the way, right? So that's everyday creativity. And there's a sense in which we need that as much now as we ever have, although we have very good evidence, even from the artifacts they left behind, that people who lived millions of years ago, thousands of years ago, hundreds of thousands of years ago, people also engaged in that kind of creative problem solving, and that's how they lived to face another day, right? Then there's this other sort of creativity that takes place, which I think of as creativity upon demand. And that's where something is demanded of you by an organization or, in the case of an educational institution, sometimes in an educational setting. When we think about that kind of creativity as it gets expressed, that's done within a very narrowly defined set of constraints. I mean, the world itself presents constraints to you when you engage in that little C everyday creativity. But many times in certain kinds of settings, whether in business or in educational institutions, you have a frame given for you. And it is an exercise in creativity that still has to be exercised on your part. But we tend not to think about some of those things as creative. So when I'm in a math class, I don't really think about that I'm engaging in creative activity, but in fact, I might be. Now, other times I'm actually focused on an algorithm. Somebody teaches me an algorithm, a set method by which something is solved. And then I learn how to apply that. I learn things in that process, but am I being creative? Well, probably not really. I'm executing around a set of procedures that I've been taught. But I think even artists would say, you have to be taught certain things by someone. You have to learn from somewhere, because trial and error learning by itself, it's a great teacher, but it's the most expensive teacher on earth. So why go through that, right? So we have formal ways of teaching you different processes, different algorithms, if you will, and they're in all different disciplines, and they vary by discipline and by context and situation. And that's an example where I'm not being less creative, but I'm learning toolkits. I'm expanding my toolkit, my mental toolkit, my physical toolkit, my aesthetic toolkit. And that, of course, lends itself to me being ever more, to increase my capacity for creativity in the future because I have a set of tools. And the more tools I have, in fact, the more creative I can be when I face different situations, some of which might be in a very constrained, clearly constrained box, and others of which are much more open-ended. So we view these things as, and part of our messaging is, people have this almost infinite capacity to grow in their creative expression across their lifetime. We have an amazing ability as human beings, even little children exhibit this, to imagine things that do not yet exist, to imagine a future, to create imaginary worlds. You see even little children doing this when they're playing. They have imaginary playmates. We worry about them, of course, if those playmates continue throughout their whole lifetime. But even young children have the capacity to imagine things, worlds they've never seen, things they've never experienced. And that's how we create our futures, or we simply let the future happen to us. But as active players in the world we inhabit, we help create the future. We do that in part by imagining a different future. So some of the work we do is even at an organizational or at a systems sort of level, where you're trying to think about, how could our city be different? How could our town be different? How could we take a problem that has manifested itself within our community, and how can we come at a solution to this problem in some new way? And that really requires the explicit exercise of both imagination, creativity, and a whole set of tools to figure out how to adapt those ideas in a real context, in a real physical place, and make them work.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about culture and creativity, and our guests in the studio were the featured presenters at UMD's second annual Creativity Conference. They're Nora Naranjo-Morse, a potter, poet, and sculptor, and Dennis Cheek, the founding executive director of the National Creativity Network. Nora, you come from a background that's more drenched in creativity. Art was very much a part of your growing up and is very much a part of your everyday life. Talk about that a little bit.
I think that what Dennis is saying is really important, because the tools that I were given as I was growing up were from the people that knew their sense of who they were and how it related to the environment they lived in. And so when they started gathering these tools and sharing them with people in my generation, we were expected to be capable, because we came from a generation who had to survive in specific ways. We, as in my generation, had to survive in different ways, but we still had these tools that had been passed down all the way from all of these generations. And so with these tools, they were important and the foundation of how I started looking at the world and how I started learning about my sense of self and place in the world that I lived in and how that made me capable of surviving. And I think surviving is a real creative tool, so that how you do it, how you navigate through that is really crucial. And what that does to me, and they're really, in the Tewa language of the Pueblos, there is really no word for art. It really is the thought about how you live an artful life, how you live a beautiful life, or how your life is balanced. So when that is taught to you at a very early age and you see that, the imagining of creating that is really a force inside of you, so that when you approach a challenge or a situation as you get older, you have that inside of you, knowing that those are the tools that you can access. And I think it's really important now, especially in this process of continued acculturation in the indigenous communities, that we really access those tools that have been given to us by the people who came before us. And they're very simple. They're very profound, because if you look at a piece of pottery that someone has done from the Pueblos, you see this balance. You see this artfulness. And they probably, the woman who made it, was probably also raising children. They were probably cooking, canning. They were doing a number of things that were equally important to them, so that sitting down to make something was just part of the rest of the flow of their life. It was not compartmentalized. It was something that, I don't know the word, it was just part of what you did. It wasn't a pedestal sitting thing that we're taught in the larger culture to think of as art in a museum. It was just something that was in your home that you used for ceremonial or utilitarian purposes. And when it was no longer useful, you put it outside and it melted back into the ground.
Let's talk a little bit about what you folks are going to be bringing to UMD students. Part of your visit here to Duluth is, and to UMD, is a lot of interaction with students. What kinds of things are you going to be talking with them about?
Foreign languages and creativity. So, of course, it's important to recognize that language itself is a human creation, and it constantly evolves. The largest vocabulary in the world is found in English, and there's over 1.5 million words in the English language. French has the next largest vocabulary, and then it goes all the way down to languages that only have a few hundred or thousand words or so. Language is the means by which you make sense of the world around you. It's how you express the sense-making you are doing to other people. It's how often you capture certain things you believe you've learned about the world, and you pass them on to subsequent people who may or may not read it or may or may not be stimulated or agree with what you said. But language then, in that sense, is very fundamentally part of being human. We move from that general discussion about language and the way in which it is by itself a very expression of human creativity that's been manifested down through millennia. Thousands of different languages. You know, there's over 7,000 spoken languages in the world right now, living languages in the world. But we know by extrapolation, if the world's population from the beginning of human beings being on planet Earth, it's estimated by demographers that's maybe 130 billion people who have lived before us, they invented languages. Thousands and thousands of languages that we don't even have access to anymore, as well as extinct languages that we know about and can still read, like Sumerian, Akkadian. You know, you think about languages from the ancient Near East, for example, Mayan from the New World. And when you think about language then, of course, you also think about some contemporary challenges we have with languages. Here at UMD, there's a requirement that students actually really work. If they're a cultural entrepreneurship major, they actually have to learn a language other than the language of their native tongue. And that's important because it introduces you to a whole different way of thinking that is encapsulated somehow in the words of that language and in the manner in which that language is actually used, its own grammatical rules, the ways in which it operates, how it expresses reality and thoughts about reality. So if you take French, for example, as comparison to English, you know, the French have a saying that says, the English play chess, we talk. And there's a very real sense in which when you listen to a native French speaker, there's a very philosophical kind of expression within French as you're having a conversation about virtually anything, where you kind of sidle up to a topic sort of slowly and you really encapsulate a broader environment as you discuss that. Whereas English, especially American English, tends to be very abrupt in contrast to this and very direct.
Nora, did you grow up speaking English in your home or did you grow up speaking two languages?
Two languages. Both my parents are from Santa Clara, and so there was English. And because we were at that point living very close to a town that was not native, and there were both languages spoken in the family.
So there were words in one language for things that there were not words for in the other and vice versa?
Right. And that it was really made apparent to me because we would listen to these prayers at home and then go to school. And there was just a whole other method of understanding things. And because of that, when I was in the school system, a lot of my friends who were from the indigenous community that we were from had a very difficult time in reading and understanding. Several of them dropped out, and that, you know, really speaks to the attrition rate of Native students in universities and high schools. So it's that idea of how do you skip from one part to the next and back and forth. And it becomes, you know, it becomes a challenge, I think. Unless you're really capable of doing that, I think it really presents all of these challenges that speak to why so many students just aren't capable of doing American schoolwork because they're so geared to thinking about going to a clay pit with their elders and hearing a prayer that has these very poetic and beautiful sounding imagery, and then having to go and, in my generation, hear about Dick and Jane. How do you make that connection? So it's really challenging.
Do you think in English or in the indigenous language that you grew up speaking?
Both, you know, depending on, I live in an English world. I really do. I mean, the computer's English, everything is English. And really what's happening in the Tewa language is that there's a real concerted effort to bring the language back. But interestingly enough, in my community, there's a real resistance about putting it on the computer. And for kids, that's what they understand. That's their world. And so if you can't see it on the computer, but you're reading it and you're expected to take it home and be conversant with your family members, then that becomes a challenge because the TV is on and you don't get the table language there. So that it becomes really specific and isolated in some cases, and then it becomes less and less spoken.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. We're talking about culture and creativity, and our guests in the studio were the featured presenters at UMD's second annual Creativity Conference. They're Nora Naranjo Morse, a potter, poet, and sculptor, and Dennis Cheek, the founding executive director of the National Creativity Network.
Yeah, I had the students in class imagine what it would be like if magically overnight they lost all knowledge of English and they woke up in the morning and it wasn't there anymore. There was nothing in their head that was related to English. No English words, no English vocabulary, no English grammar. And to just play out in their mind, what would your next 24 hours be like? And then we moved into a discussion about this very fact that these indigenous languages are rapidly disappearing, not only in the United States, but globally. And that unless a more systematic approach arises to really head off this problem amongst indigenous speakers and amongst wider populations, we are going to face a point in the future where very few of these indigenous languages will survive. The Maoris have taken very aggressive action around this in New Zealand. The Hawaiians have had considerable success in Hawaii about transmitting their language and via their language also their cultural worldviews and things to the rising generations. But if we don't do more and if we cannot figure out ways to work in partnership with each other together, which is another effort we're trying to think about with lots and lots of different people around the United States and even outside the United States around this particular issue, we believe that unless we figure out a way to self-organize around this issue effectively within the next 5 years, 50 years from now, there will be no conversation about this because most of these languages will have totally disappeared. And while some languages, a few, have been brought back from that total extinction, that's an extremely difficult proposition. And you don't want to simply become, you know, a case study of a now extinct language like Sumerian or Akkadian or these languages from the ancient Near East. It's very, very important that people really grasp the importance of this. Because when you have these conversations sometimes in communities, all kinds of people will then rise up and somehow say this is un-American to, you know, teach these other languages. And yet, you know, one of the things we know here at UMD is a position that's been taken that says, no, language, in fact, multiple language facility, being able to think fully in another language, to pick up pieces of literature, to create things, to express things, to tell stories in another language is a very enriching personal experience, but it also is one of those kind of tools in your toolkit that enables you to be more creative, more imaginative, and more innovative, and gives you the capacity also, I think, sometimes to more readily put yourself in the other person's shoes for a moment. And that in and of itself, the sort of ability to distance yourself volitionally and purposefully from your own culture and to sit in someone else's place for a little bit, even if only a little bit. That's an important perspective you need to be able to take if you're going to navigate your way successfully around the world. And I say that as somebody who's traveled very extensively in the world and worked very extensively outside the United States, and I've lived outside the United States for 7 years in three different countries. It's very important to be able to do that. That's a critical life skill for the world in which we live, where increasingly you are, in fact, traveling more, you're conversing more, and where we have many, many conflicts that at their roots, some of these conflicts also wrap around this inability to understand the situation from someone else's perspective. the fact that they have legitimacy to some of the ways in which they've constructed their sense of the world that are quite different than how my own culture has constructed its sense and its understanding of the world. And I don't have to agree with it, but I at least have to acknowledge that it's real, that it's genuine, and that there are reasons, historical and otherwise, cultural, there are many reasons why these different views are held. And this is a critical component, I believe, of 21st century literacy in the fullest and best sense of the word. And it inures back to the creative process, the set of skills you're able to bring to bear in a particular situation to solve problems that face you in the real world or that face groups of people or organizations in the real world to be effective.
Nora, I'm really interested in particular, since Duluth is really, really passionate about public art. We have public art funding. We have public art projects. We've got public art on display in our city council chambers now. Duluth is really excited about public art. And public art, in particular, this project that you were just talking about, the Longhouse Project, mm-hmm. the Swimming Together installation that you just worked on. What's so magical about public art, to your way of thinking?
Generally, I'm in the studio by myself, and I really treasure that. And every now and then, I get asked to do a public art project. And I think what it does, it opens the door of communication with all sorts of other people. And you start cultivating their ideas. And if you listen closely enough, they're full of ideas, and they're wanting to share them. And if you listen, then you can start incorporating them into an idea that maybe you have, and that's when the collaboration begins, everyone feeling like they can contribute. And I think that was one of the cultural informants that I had when I was growing up, is that I was listened to. Somebody wanted to know what I was thinking. And that, as a child, of course, gives you great great self-awareness and confidence. And I think that's one of the things that I really treasure about public art, is that if you do it in collaboration with all of these other people, even administrative people, you know, they are having ideas, and they come from completely different resources and perspectives, but everyone comes together and starts working on something that is unified and that eventually articulates all of this communication and this sharing. So I enjoy it. I did a very big project at the Smithsonian, National Museum of the American Indian. And in the corridor, there's about 1.6 million people that go back and forth every day. And there was a group of nine of us who worked on this ephemeral sculpture at NMAI. And people would stop and sit and watch us. Then the next day, they would come back and they would ask if they could help us. And then the next day, they'd bring their mother. The next day, they would bring their children. And this became an event every day for like almost a month, where people could work with us and help us build. And then 2 years later, return and tell their children or their friends, I helped make that. And so that's really, that's unifying, that's important. That goes to the basic thing of how I grew up, is that communally we gathered and we spent a lot of time together, and we built things. We built homes, we built ovens, we built pottery, so that a pottery wasn't just one person. It was a collection of different energies coming together.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Nora Naranjo-Morse, a potter, poet, and sculptor, and Dennis Cheek, the founding executive director of the National Creativity Network. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.